The Blue Cliff Record, Case 84, Non-Duality. Introduction. Even if you say yes, yes cannot affirm anything. Even if you say no, no cannot deny anything. When yes and no are left behind, and gain and loss are both forgotten, you are clean and naked, free and at ease. Now tell me, what is before you and behind you? If a Zen monk comes forth and says, "Before us is the Buddha shrine and the main gateway, behind us is the dormitory and the abbot's room," tell me, does this person have eyes or not? If you can judge this individual accurately, I will admit that you have seen the ancients in person. The case. Vimalakirti asked Manjushri, "What is a bodhisattva's entry into the teaching of non-duality?" Manjushri said, "In my opinion, making no verbalization or representation of anything at all, leaving behind all dialogue, is entry into the teaching of non-duality." Now Manjushri asked Vimalakirti, "We have each spoken. Now it's your turn. What is a bodhisattva's entry into the teaching of non-duality?" Sekho said, "What did Vimalakirti say?" Sekho also said, "Exposed." My husband and I took an early ski day in December during the week, took a day off, and went to Killington to do some skiing. There was fresh snow, wonderful day to be there, not many people. And it really was a splendid time to be on the mountain. So we enjoyed ourselves zooming down the trail, sometimes together. Sometimes we would go our separate ways and then meet up again later. And the day went on, really just a perfect day. Close to the end of the day, we were really tired. And we knew from past experience not to push too much beyond that point, lest there be injuries. But we were loath to give up the day, too. So we decided that we would go to the easiest of the mountains at Killington, and to the easiest run on the easiest mountain, hardly any downhill to it at all, and just enjoy the swooping turns and this gentle slope as our last run. So we made our way over to that area, rode the lift up, and started right down the center. The easiest trail was right down the middle under the chairlift, and very broad, trees on both sides, beautiful view of the mountains in the distance. My husband sort of went over to one side of the trail, ducking in and out of the trees. He likes to court disaster. And I went right down the center. How often are you at Killington when there's no one else there? It's just wide open. I took up all the space. And so we were coming up to the bottom. Well, I was. He was behind me some. We were coming up to the end of the trail when I noticed someone off to one side who was waving his arms and calling to me. So I veered over in his direction to see what was up. There was a friend, I suppose, there with him who was stretched out on the snow. Kids, you know, they do that. Just enjoying full contact. And so I went over and asked him what was up. And he said, "You've got to go for help. I don't know what's wrong. This person won't get up." And I saw the other person stretched out in the snow and thought, are these kids, like, are they playing a trick on me? Something doesn't seem right about this. And I said, "Is this for real?" And he said, "No, you've got to go now. You have to go for help." I can't get this person to get up again. And so I went over to the other person stretched out on the snow. They were stretched out face down. So I couldn't see anything except for, you know, all the ski gear, the helmet, the gloves, the boots, the skis had come off. Just a wisp of hair coming out the side of the helmet. It was my only hint that there was a person under there. I had the strange feeling that this wasn't really a human. There was something odd about the angle of the leg. And so still. So still. I'd never seen anyone be so still. And that's when I realized what I was looking at. So I told him to stay there and I would hurry for help to go and get the ski patrol. And I took off as fast as I've ever skied, straight down that slope, and got to the lift. I noticed on the way down that the sun had broken through the clouds on the mountains far beyond. It was shining gloriously. It seemed so incongruous. How could that happen? So I told the liftie at the bottom that there was someone unconscious who needed help up on the slope. Please send the ski patrol. And I waited for my husband to join me. As I was waiting, the liftie said he'd called the ski patrol. Not to worry. Go on up and have some fun. There's still time to make some good turns on the mountain. It was the farthest thing from my mind. It's funny how people offer comfort, what he felt would be comfort. So I told my husband briefly what had happened. He hadn't seen it. He was off to another side of the trail. And we rode back up on the chairlift because it was our only way to get back to where we had started. And as we rode, we crossed over the body in the snow and the other person waiting with it, now joined by ski patrollers already, the toboggan to take this person down the mountain. And I burst into tears seeing that. So we made our way back to the lodge where we had started, gathered up our gear, got back into the car and headed home. It was amazing to me how a day so full of joy could turn so quickly into sorrow. We had not a word to say to each other, maybe two sentences the whole way home, the three-hour drive. And on the way, my mind would not stop putting together a story of what might have happened. Had to have an explanation. This body was out in the middle of the trail. No trees to have run into. Far from the chairlift pole, but directly under the chairlift. The slope was much too gentle for anyone to have been going so fast that a collision would cause such injury. So the only thing I could think of was that someone had fallen off the chairlift. And by the size of the body, such a small, frail-looking body, I thought perhaps a child, like 14, a young adult, goofing around up there and slipped. No one to see it until this fellow came upon him. That was the story that my mind chose to settle in with. If you call it settled, it felt very unsettled. So finally, we got home, and I checked to see if there were any reports from Killington, because they do report injuries. And sure enough, there was one there. And it said that there had been a death at Killington, that it was an 80-year-old man whose heart had stopped. I felt such relief. It was the same exact situation, but instead of being a terrible tragedy of some child whose mother would have by now been weeping over that inert body. It was an old man who perhaps had been enjoying that last moment. We don't know. Then I wanted to make up all the stories about what had happened on the way down. But somehow I felt relief. So it wasn't tragedy, or perhaps not. Perhaps it was just a sad occasion. I went to work the next day and told a coworker who enjoys skiing, told her about what had happened. And her first response was, "How wonderful to have dropped over, to have taken your last breaths, zooming down the ski slope, not moldering away in some hospital bed, not slowly withering, suffering, but just to be doing this exhilarating thing, and then an end to it." I hadn't thought of it that way. So was it a tragedy, or was it a sad event, or was it kind of wonderful? I really couldn't settle into anywhere with this. As I thought back on it, this joyous day, the sorrowful day, this young person, old person, woman or man, couldn't tell them. Life, death, tragedy, wonderful. What do you say? Where do you settle in? Thank you.
And so these days on retreat, we will actually have two teachers. The first presents the case and the second rebuts it or tries to build on it or do something. Always so wonderful to go on adventures with Kate. I have been on many adventures with her here in this very room. And I have been on many adventures with many of you here on this very room as we begin our time of playing together. All of us have escaped from our lives. All of us, for some reason, something so important, so urgent, has called us here. Of course, many things to do, many important things, many obligations. And yet, here you are. Here I am. And I think exactly as Kate suggests, we are trying to settle the matter. What is going on here? All of us find ourselves breathing in and out, find ourselves cycling through the many realms, cycling through realms of clarity and realms of confusion, realms of hopefulness and realms of discouragement. And this wonderful case that we will be picking up over these next few days together comes from the story, the Sutra of Vimalakirti, The Sutra Vimalakirti is one of the early sutras of the Mahayana school, appearing several hundred years after the Buddha's life. And this particular sutra is noteworthy in several ways. And one of the most unusual parts of this sutra is that the hero is not a monk. In the Buddha's time, and as Buddhism first arose, it was practiced mostly by monks and nuns. And if you decided to pursue the Buddha way, you left your life, you left the world, and joined the Sangha. You became a home leaver. The Vimalakirti Sutra is actually the first one that talks about a practitioner of a great attainment who was a householder. Vimalakirti was someone who had practiced and devoted himself to the way, but chose to stay in the world, chose to stay as a householder. And he was recognized by the Sangha as one of a person of deep insight. And it is indeed in Vimalakirti's tradition that all of us practice. All of us in this room, of course, in one way we are monks and nuns, but all of us also householders. Even Melissa and I, who live in the temple, have day jobs. And this form of practice is one of the, we might say, continuing innovations as Zen has come to the West. In Japan and China, the tradition of the people who meditated were the priests and the monks and nuns. But here, as Zen has come and rooted in America in the latter part of the 20th century, and now in the 21st century, most practitioners are people like you and me. And these retreats are the great privilege and the great training path, where we come to study, and we all have this rhythm of entering in to this life, this quite simple life. The Han sounds, we come down to the meditation hall, bell rings, we sit still, bell rings again, we stand up. One of the wonderful things about this week is that you don't have to make many decisions. Usually we have to think, do I go here, do I go there? What will I have for lunch? When will I eat? Part of the gift of retreat is this container. We are taken care of, our tenzos and the, everyone helping in the kitchen, our servers, as Melissa said, such a great fortune. And we look into this matter. How can I settle this matter? Kate's story so vividly illustrates how all of us, how the mind just wants a clear story. We often get people new to Zen and new to Buddhism and come in the temple, and sometimes they'll come and after a sitting and say, so I really want to study Zen. What should I do? And I say, well, you've just done it. They're not quite sure what to make of that. They want some kind of program. Give me the curriculum. Well, of course, the curriculum is your life. And as we hear these stories, actually we were speaking this morning in the teachers' meeting of how often when we study something, there's some kind of, we read to understand something outside of us. We approach it from the place we don't know, and we will read this text and then we will find out. But the study of Zen works just opposite. When we study and practice here in silence and stillness on the cushion, the whole world comes to teach us. And when we hear these stories, the point is not to to learn something you don't know, but to find that place of correspondence. The teaching is that all of us have the Buddha nature. There is a wisdom beyond wisdom that is life itself in the form of you. And usually we are looking somewhere else. Zen is the project of looking right here. And these koans and the wonderful readings from our liturgy service are to point our attention to our own experience. And so Vimalakirti was one of the great disciples of Buddha. And one day he didn't appear at one of the teachings, and the Buddha sent Manjushri to go find him. What's happening? Where is he? Is he okay? And Vimalakirti went to Manjushri went to Vimalakirti's house, went to his room, apparently a quite small room, 10 by 10. And when Manjushri went, all of the many bodhisattvas and arhats, thousands and thousands of bodhisattvas and arhats went with Manjushri, and they all fit into this room. And Manjushri said to Vimalakirti, how is it with you, brother? And Vimalakirti said, I am sick because the world is sick. I am sick because the world is sick. A wonderful presentation of the interdependence of our life. We imagine we are separate, that we can be safe when others are not safe, that we can find a path just for ourselves. Vimalakirti from thousands of years ago reminds us we are part of this suffering world. And then Vimalakirti chose the opportunity to teach, and so he asked all of the assembled bodhisattvas and arhats this question, what is the entry point into this teaching? What is the entry point into Bodhisattva's gate of not two? This Dharma, this teaching of oneness, what is your understanding? And the story goes that all of the bodhisattvas and arhats answered this. Many of them had wonderful answers. And Manjushri was last, and this is where the koan begins. And after Manjushri spoke, he said to Vimalakirti, now your turn, buddy. what is the entry gate into this Dharma, this world of oneness? And Vimalakirti said, and this is known as the thundering silence of Vimalakirti. Thank you. So I invite you to sit comfortably, and we turn this way if you'd like, and we'll have our Dharma dialogue, the time to come forward with observations or questions, and we have Dharma holder Steve Wallace up here, and Steve and Kate and I will respond to your questions.
My favorite part of this koan is Manjushri's first three words. And Manjushri is the bodhisattva of wisdom and should really have a handle on the truth, right? The first few words are, in my opinion.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it wakes me up.
Stuff is. And, I find myself kind of caught up in that. But what I know is probably familiar to most people, which is, am I doing this right? Am I screwing up? Am I, you know, the kid just can't quite pull it together? And I think, well, okay, that's what's there for me. And so is that the answer, or is that a yes or a no? You know, and is this what I should be trying not to have because it's okay, or should I be having it because I'm having it? And so there's a yes and a no, and a bit of a loss for words, which is probably a good thing. Thank you.
Well put. One of the wonderful things about all of the forms of retreat is it puts us into this place of yes and no, right and wrong. The beginning that Kate read, the introduction here. The human mind wants to create this binary, and you can feel the pull of it, and then doubting it. Well, it's not really true. So indeed, as you say, this is life. And I think the encouragement is to be present to the particularness of this, not. Which is different than following the thoughts. I mean, you can engage in the philosophical and go that way, but that's actually not what we're doing here. But what's it like when I don't know if I'm doing it right? What's it like when the stories just go in my mind? And then in that place, there is just observing what's here. And some possibility for entering in some place that does not fall into yes or no.
And so we're so quick to want to find the answer, right? And this is kind of what Manjushri is presenting, right? If only I can stop my mind from doing this thing that it does, then there's this opening of, you know, something beyond my ordinary day-to-day life. And so he's not entirely wrong, right? That sometimes there are openings beyond the ordinary day-to-day life that we find ourselves in. And yet, if we reduce it to a thing, right, now I know. I just need to stop doing this thing with my mind, and then things will clarify, right? And maybe that's not it. This messiness that you're experiencing in, you know, not being confident in the forms of Sashin is not actually an accident, right? I mean, this is one of the functions of Sashin forms. And this is something that functions at all levels, right? That even people that have done this dozens of times are still subject to screwing up the forms, if you're not paying close attention, right? And this is actually a wonderful opportunity, right, for each of us, you know, and particularly people that have been around for a while. When you screw up the form in a visible way, there's this feeling that comes, oh my God, I'm supposed to be beyond this, you know. It's okay for new people to screw up, but somebody like me shouldn't screw up this way, right? And there's this intense reaction that can come up. But what if getting past that is not the goal?
thank you all. I appreciate it. And Kate, the story you told, talking about, death is, there's this great question of what draws us, at least for me, here. Why? Like, what is this all about? And how even after you knew the facts, you were able to tell a different story, but you still needed a story. And how, what you were pointing to for me is how that need to put something in concrete, to say, I know that's the way things are because I need to know that, removes the curiosity of just the grandness of what may be completely unknowable. But just live in that curiosity. And yet we're still trying to keep telling a story. So thank you.
And it didn't seem like a problem. Like on the drive home, as my mind was churning through the possibilities, I could see it was unstoppable. You know, there was that part of me that was like, okay, I guess we just have to sit through this and, you know, let the mind do what it needs to do and draw its conclusions, but not totally buying into it, right? That's the difference. And that's the curiosity remaining open. What might come next? What might be another part of the story? The whole thing is a wonderment. I don't know now what to say. It's very helpful to tell the story.
Yeah, Barry, back there. Yeah, they.
Thank you, Kate, for that. I felt like I was really in the emotional state. I think one thing I always find about the koan is that I have a lot of resistance to it, especially sort of like picturing him in his room just like sulking in a way, and especially the response of being quiet. And maybe that's because it really, like, hits a part of me that, wants to just do that and not engage. And for some reason, I feel this, like, sense of annoyance. and also, I feel very much like, I just wanted to
I didn't hear that last part. You feel very much like...
very much like him.
Oh.
Well, and it's wonderful that, so we're talking about stories now, and of course koans are nothing but stories, and something about us human beings and the story-making capacity enters our mind in some way. So as we hear these, it's not just an intellectual investigation, but all of us hear the story, and all of us have some response to it. It may be like, oh, I don't know anything, or this irritation that comes up. Who does he think he was? You know, stay in there, you know? So we're invited to explore these, right? One teacher says, everything we encounter is ourselves. And sometimes we encounter ourselves in a very irritating form. And then as we stay with this, and I think as we stay with ourselves, as Kate was saying, we can be interested in how the story shifts. Right? The mind thinks, well, I know what he was doing, and that's a stupid thing to do. So maybe not. Maybe he wasn't doing that at all. Maybe something totally different. We investigate these koans by staying with what arises for us. So if this irritation, like how dare he do that, and I'd really like to do that myself, comes up, we notice that. And then as we talk about this and as we explore it, we hold our conclusions lightly to see, okay, so that's a story. I wonder what else is here? Or I wonder what is in here? What's at the heart of this irritation? And so they are all stories designed to disturb us. So thank you for sharing your disturbance.
So, Faye, that's a very interesting take on what Vimalakirti is doing here, and it hadn't really come up for me in quite that way, right? That he's irritated and morose and wishing that things were different. And my first reaction was, no, I don't think so. But as I reflect on it, what if that's exactly what he was doing, right? Was sitting there and feeling like life isn't fair. Why am I sick, you know? Because this has been coming up a lot for me lately, right? I've been terribly ill the last few months. And I know that you, Faye, are no stranger to that, feeling quite ill. And it's so unfair, isn't it? You know, this illness. He says, I'm sick because the world is sick. You know, the whole world is sick. And I hate it. I don't like this. It isn't fair. I want it to be some other way. Right? And along comes Manjushri and says, well, just don't bother yourself with all of this. And if you just appreciate the grand beauty of the world as it is, then you'll see this other side of it, and everything will be delightful. And perhaps Vimalakirti is saying, well, so that's not so exactly my experience, but nonetheless, the aliveness, my opportunity for my life is right here, right now. This is what's on offer. You know, this moment is what it is. Just allowing things to be as they are. What if that's enough?
Yeah, Cheryl.
I really appreciated the story that Kate told, because I felt like I was right there feeling that. You know, it evoked a lot of emotion. You know, thinking about somebody dying on the ski slope, and then the way the story shifted. And then I started realizing that what a wonderful thing that I could feel this. You know, that I was kind of like, I'm stuck, but I really appreciate this feeling that I have right now, even though it could be a tragedy, it could be a blessing, and even though it might have been an old man, it still could have been a tragedy. You know, somebody could be mourning him, but that feeling that was evoked, I'm just kind of stopping to honor that. That is a very powerful thing, so thank you.
Well, so last night I said something about welcoming all that it is to be human. And that's what I hear you doing. also welcoming that sorrowful feeling, and this other first person who asked a question, welcoming the confusion of not knowing if he's got the forms quite right, and Faye welcoming the irritation that she's feeling, you know, like that is what it is to be human. How wonderful that we can feel all of these things. Even how wonderful that we can try not to, and that it breaks through again and again. The whole great catastrophe.
I think that's a lovely note to end on. The whole great catastrophe.